again, medical education podcast listeners. This is Kevin Eva, the editor-in-chief of the journal, speaking to you from Vancouver, where spring has finally sprung and we're getting some nice warm and dry weather, thankfully. Today I'm going to be looking partway across the continent to chat with Rachel Wolfson, who is co-director of scholarship and discovery for the University of Chicago Pritzker School of Medicine. And she and her co-authors have a paper coming out in the August 2017 issue of Medical Education called Goals of Medical Students Participating in Scholarly Concentration Programs. Thanks, Rachel, for making the time to chat.
Thanks for having me.
Things are blooming in Chicago, too, I hope, at this point.
Beautiful spring. Yeah. Absolutely beautiful. And we definitely deserve it, just as you do.
Yeah. It was a long, cold and wet one for us, yeah. This paper obviously is about scholarly concentration programs. I think it's fairly intuitive what that means, but I imagine many parts in the world won't use that phrase. Can I start by asking you to give us a sense of what that means in your context and what sort of things you would lump into that category?
Sure. So scholarly concentration programs really describe a diverse group of programs at different schools that allow students to integrate a longitudinal scholarly experience in parallel with the traditional four-year curriculum. So not the students who get an advanced degree or take time off for a PhD, but students who will generally complete their medical education in either 4 or sometimes 5 years and do a scholarly project on top of what we would ordinarily consider to be the required curriculum.
Right, so these aren't ways of getting into medical school. These are all students who are already fully admitted and they're choosing to do this on top. Are there admission requirements, though, to enable one to do that, or is it largely by choice?
Sure. So it's interesting. Some of these programs are optional, but at a larger and larger number of schools, they're required. So our program is required. The program at Mount Sinai, the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai, where our co-author Karen Zier is on the faculty, their program is required. You can think of schools like Duke University that have had a full year dedicated to scholarly work for decades now. So there are a lot of schools where these programs are required for all students who are admitted. So students know coming in that this is something that they'll be expected to participate in. And many students choose to go to these schools because they want the faculty support and mentorship that will come from a required program. And then there are also many schools that have optional activities for students, but clearly it's not required for graduation.
Okay, and these are becoming increasingly common, I understand, in medical school curricula. What are the arguments that are being put forward for schools putting more and more focus in this direction?
So that's really interesting. I actually run the National Scholarly Concentrations Collaborative, so we get together every year at the Association of American Medical Colleges meeting that's in November every year. And when you speak with this group of educators, the reasons for having these programs center around the maturation of a student's ability to develop a scientific question, to develop rigorous methods, to actually have the stamina to carry the project out and understand how much effort that takes, and then to be able to communicate their results. And it really centers around developing students as critical thinkers. No one assumes that all or even 50% of their students are going to end up as NIH-funded researchers necessarily, but being able to ask a question and have a rigorous approach to getting to the answer is a cornerstone of being a physician. And so all of these programs aim to develop those skills. There are certainly a subset of programs that are aiming to get their students into academic jobs, but you don't need that piece of it in order to really be focused on the scientific method issue and how to really develop critical thinkers.
You mentioned that at least some students are choosing medical schools because of the existence of these programs. Did you have much sense coming into this project of what they were hoping to get out of it? Is it just an awareness typically of the importance of being able to reason through problems like you just described, or are some more likely to be doing it because they actually want that academic career?
So that's a really good question. So we went into this thinking that we knew what our goals were for the students, but we wondered what their goals were. And there has been for a long time this sort of urban legend that the students who want to go into residencies, where the match process is extremely competitive, are very focused on getting that publication, on having the research with the high power mentor on their CV so that when they go for their residency interviews, they really stand out. And we wondered if that was urban legend or to some degree if that was true, and what our students were coming to medical school hoping to get out of these programs. And that's really where this project originally came from, was trying to understand that.
Okay, and you chose to use a survey methodology and included two U.S. schools, and you've already named them, but was there a particular reason other than the convenience of you and a co-author being at those schools that you thought they would be good representations of what students were trying to get out of these types of programs?
So this really was a convenient sample, and we wanted to look for a partner school that had a similar requirement to what we did and whose students understood coming in that this is what they would be required to do. We would have to have a much broader sample in order to look at all medical students across the country. If you're trying to look from an admission standpoint, why a student might choose one school versus another, depending on the rigor or the age of the program, how mature the program is, how used to working with medical students the faculty are, et cetera. So we really just wanted to understand what our students want to get out of this. And when we had the opportunity to work with colleagues at a medical school with a similar structure in terms of protected time and requirements for graduation and things like that, it was a good partnership.
Mm-hmm. And how did you decide what goals to ask them about? What framework were you using to try to determine even what they might plausibly report back to you?
Sure. So we started with a list of things that we were hoping our students would get out of participation in the program. And then we also give our students, as they enter medical school every year, an intake assessment that asks about their prior experience with research, what they're hoping to get out of the program, et cetera, just in narrative form. Some questions are non-narrative, but many are narrative, asking about their previous experiences and things like that. We use this information to recommend possible mentors to them, mm-hmm. but we now have many years historically going back looking at these. And so we also considered some of the goals that pop up in those narrative responses and included them. We shared them with our student, who's actually the first author on the paper, Kurt Alberson, and he helped us to narrow some things down where he thought that he would look at things and maybe think they were too similar or something was really, you know, off in left field, and helped us to narrow down to what we thought was a broad enough list, but also not so overwhelming that people would open the survey and just not answer it.
Right.
Right. I mean, I could present them with 50 goals, but I'll get no responses.
Absolutely. And so you settled on some skill-related goals, some accomplishment-related goals, and mentorship. And that mm-hmm. leads me to want to clarify, are the students in your program responsible then for finding their own mentor, or is there a pairing process that you go through?
Sure. They're responsible for finding their own mentor, but we give them a lot of support with that. So every student receives a personalized letter in the fall of their first year after they've completed our intake assessment, where we look at fields that they might be interested, the kinds of mentors they've worked well with in the past. We ask if they like someone who's really involved or someone who steps away a little. We ask if they're interested in basic science or global health, like to really get an idea of where their interests lie. And we give them three specific recommendations of people to start with. And we tell them, this may not be your one true mentor, but maybe they'll connect you with the right person. We also provide them with a book. We have about 80 students in each class. The book typically has twice as many opportunities where faculty have said, yes, I'd love to work with a student. Mm-hmm. And we provide them with a printed book that describes the project. It lists all of the students the faculty has worked with in the past. So if the students want to reach out and understand from their upperclassmen how that experience was, they can. And we also introduce all of our students to our track leaders. So our program has 7 tracks based on content. So basic science, community health, global health, medical education, et cetera. And the students are all introduced to the leaders of each of those tracks in the fall of their first year. And those folks can also act as point people if, despite our efforts to give them these other resources, they still feel like they need some extra direction. So they do have to come up with their mentor on their own, but they don't have to open up the faculty directory and start sending cold emails to people. Exactly.
Right. Well, and as you started looking at the goals that people were expressing, I know you were also trying to determine what predicted those goals, or were there subgroups of people. Can you share with our listeners what you thought to be the most interesting or intriguing results?
Well, I think the thing that actually was the most interesting is that it's always been this urban legend, right, or lore that the students who were interested in highly competitive specialties were very focused on the accomplishment. Mm-hmm. I want the publication. I want the first authorship. This is going to make my application better. And we were hoping that that wouldn't be the case. And it turns out that it was. And I think that really presents an opportunity to work with our students to develop just a deep-rooted understanding that being a physician is about mastering this massive amount of information and mastering how you interact with people. It's not about finishing medical school or finishing residency. It's about learning all of these skills as you go along the way, and that it's really incumbent upon us to take every opportunity we can to continue to ingrain that in people. The other thing that was interesting was the mentorship result. And so, you know, there's a lot of literature about mentorship being particularly important for women trainees. So I wasn't surprised to see that the ratings for mentorship were very high among women, but it was a little surprising to see that they were lower among men. And I also, in figure one, where we show that men were more interested in highly competitive residencies than women, and there was a trend toward them being more interested in career-long research, as a female physician in 2017, I was actually quite surprised by that, given the almost equity in admissions, right? If you look at a class in medical school, right, it's almost 50-50 between men and women. So I was actually somewhat surprised to see that.
Right. And how did you define those statements, interested in highly competitive specialty or interested in career-long research? Was that just the students' current statements about what track they're on, or are they close to actually pursuing those paths?
So these are first-year students, so we're getting them straight after they've started medical school. But we think that people's interests early on will frame the choices they make, mm-hmm. right? I'm not assigning them a mentor in a specific specialty, but the student who comes in and says, I'm going to be a plastic surgeon, is probably going to seek out the plastic surgeon who's funded, who's a basic scientist, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So we thought that their interests early on might inform their choices and their goals. So we approached this pretty simply. So for interest in career-long research, we used a question that comes off of the graduation questionnaire for the AAMC mm-hmm. that simply asks students the extent to which they will anticipate being involved in research in their career. And it's a 5-point scale. And students who answered exclusively involved or significantly involved, we described those students as interested. And the students who said someone involved in a limited way, or not involved at all, we categorized as not involved. So that's how we dichotomized that. For specialties, we gave 3 blanks, and we asked the students to free response their specialties of interest. And then we coded those based on what they would match into. So someone who says pediatrics is obviously coded as pediatrics. Someone who says gastroenterology will be coded as internal medicine, because you don't match into gastroenterology, right? You match into internal medicine.
Right.
And then we used a paper that was published several years ago now. I can find it. The author's last name was Green. And they described highly competitive residencies as programs that matched greater than 80% of their first-year spots to U.S. graduates. So we used, I believe, the 2015 match results from the NRMP, and skimmed off the specialties that had greater than 80% of their first-year spots taken by U.S. grads, and described those as highly competitive. That green paper was from 2009.
Great, and people can go to your article to find this specific reference if they need it.
Mm-hmm.
But again, your results are interesting to me in part because they seem parallel to the notion of people being performance-oriented or mastery-oriented, and large literature suggesting that there are different learning outcomes and different behaviors that arise when people are in one mode or the other. And mm-hmm. so I'm wondering, by way of wrapping up, are you, as the co-director of scholarship and discovery, what are you doing differently, if anything, based on the clear understanding you have now of the variety of goals that the students have for these sorts of programs?
Sure. So we've talked about how to integrate this knowledge that we have into what we do every day on the ground. And one of the things that we've really talked about is working with our students. We give instructional lectures to them on scholarship and discovery related things multiple times throughout their 4 years. So we really want to be deliberate about emphasizing that this is about the process and about acquiring the skill to be a critical thinker. To get the paper is wonderful, and we applaud that. We're not telling anybody not to pursue that, but that's not what this is about. This is about the process and about being able to communicate your work. And we continue to look for ways that we can emphasize that. We also communicate regularly with our mentors, and we've looked at ways that we can also emphasize to them that what we're really looking for is critical thinking and investment in the process, and that this is really an opportunity to teach those skills. There's so much in medical school that is performance oriented. How did you do on step one? How did you do on step two? Did you get honors in all of your clerkships? And those are important, but that's not what's going to sustain you for a 30 or 40 year career in medicine. It's being a critical thinker, being engaged in what you're doing, finding the thing that really keeps your interest. When I tell students about selecting a project, I advise them to find something that sings to them, because then they'll always be interested in asking more questions and doing more. And I feel like if we can help students to find the right specialty, find the right practice model that really sings to them and makes them invested in the process, that's where we're going to be able to make a difference. And scholarship and discovery and all the scholarly concentration programs like it really provide a unique opportunity to do that, that I think is harder to create other places in the curriculum.
Right. And it does sound like you're living that life yourself, you know, working at many different levels and trying to use the notion of scholarship and discovery both in your own efforts to study this program, but also in enabling the students to embed it in their clinical lives as well as their academic lives. So I'll just wrap up by congratulating you on this work and hope that the effort continues to pay off as it seems to be currently.
Thank you. We're having a lot of fun working on this.
I bet. For those who want the details, I'll just remind you that the title of the paper is Goals of Medical Students Participating in Scholarly Concentration Programs. I've been speaking with Rachel Wolfson, who's the senior author on the project, and you'll find it in the August 2017 issue of Medical Education. Thanks again for listening, and we'll talk with you again soon.